This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. And coming up in the second half of today's show, Sue Balcom with Main Street Eats, and she teaches us about buckwheat. But first, the lives of the people behind the newspapers. The Dakota Journalists podcast brings to life the oral histories of newspaper journalists from across both North and South Dakota. It is sponsored by the newspaper associations of both states and hosted by Terry Finneman. In this excerpt from the Dakota Journalists podcast, we hear about how early career experiences and their childhoods shaped the work that they do. Longtime Grand Forks Herald columnist Marilyn Haggerty says that one event really shaped her: the kidnapping of the Lindbergh baby. The son of the famed aviator was taken from his home in March of 1932 when Haggerty was just 6 years old.
And I remember the Bruno Hauptmann kidnapping of the Lindbergh. Boy, that was a very big news story that made an impression on me. Because I remember walking home from school one night and I saw something up in a telephone pole, and I thought it had something to do with Bruno Richard Hauptmann, and I was so scared. I mean, it was just scary for kids to hear about the Lindbergh boy, and that was big news. Of course, Shirley Temple was our pride and joy. Every Sunday we'd try to go to a movie. We had friends who had a girl our age, and we'd all go to the movies and watch Shirley Temple. Those are things that most everyone did in the 30s, in the 1930s when I was, early 40s when I was growing up.
Bob Lynn's family lived in Niagara, North Dakota, a town of just 207 people in the 1930 census.
We all listened to the radio and the news, and my dad took the newspaper, and that was it. I just remember the radio was on a lot, and my folks listened to, always caught the news, and I kind of got interested too, but again, that was it. Radio, newspapers, magazines. The big magazine, I remember, it was Life magazine. Lots of people took it. It was about it. We always watched, like on Sunday night, we always had these Jack Benny and Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy and Ozzie and Harriet. And we always listened to the same shows.
Between 1933 and 1944, another familiar voice filled the radio airwaves, that of Franklin Roosevelt and his fireside chats. The History Channel notes that 90% of Americans owned a radio in the 1930s. Roosevelt was must-listen programming for many families, no matter their political persuasion.
By saying my father was a dyed-in-the-wool Republican, and he didn't particularly like FDR. But all things said, we have to give him his due. He brought the nation together pretty well.
Nothing could top the 62 million people who tuned in on December 9th, 1941, to hear Roosevelt's war message after the attack on Pearl Harbor.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan.
And my family, see, I was about 16 years old, and my family had been invited to some relatives over by Canton. And so they thought they better keep that afternoon invitation. And so we got in the car. We had a car radio. If And we listened to the car radio all the way down there. And when we got there, these people had their radio on. And all we did was sit there and listen to that radio all afternoon to see what was happening over in Hawaii. It was quite a traumatic time and something you remember.
Roger Casa was 7 years old and had just sat down for dinner with his family in Northfield, Minnesota, when they heard the Pearl Harbor news.
My reaction was to run outside, and I had a flag that I flew every day out in my backyard. I ran outside, and I put the flag up and saluted the flag, and then went back in to eat. That was my reaction to Pearl Harbor Day. I was very proud to be an American, and I was very unhappy with the fact that we were being attacked, and I just felt sorry for the people that were being involved in the attack on Pearl Harbor.
In Illinois, Dick Lee's childhood was also heavily influenced by World War II.
We had scrap drives at school and saved metal, and we went around looking for metal and rubber and things like that, and built huge piles of metal in the schoolyard for scrap drives. And we went down every Friday and bought U.S. bonds and things like that. And I wrote about it a lot. And we played war a lot. I mean, we built little trenches and wore helmets and all of that sort of stuff. War was very important to us.
The same was true for Bob Lind.
You know, from the time U.S. got into it from Pearl Harbor in 41 until it ended in 45, that's when I was a kid, you know. The things that were associated with it, like rationing for groceries and gas and tires, and the guys are going into the military. 41, I was, 8 years old, you know. I do remember, I started reading that, checking the newspaper, even as a kid, because I think maybe probably primarily because of the war, everybody's talking about it. I got in following the war and learning about places that maybe I wouldn't have otherwise, but you know, the places in North Africa where the early fighting was going, and of course the fightings in the Pacific. I mean, who would have heard of Iwo Jima and Okinawa and so on if it hadn't been for the war? Well, I got interested, and the Minneapolis Tribune one time came out with a big map of the world. Then they also printed little flags of the countries involved in the war, both the Allied and the enemy. And you cut out the flag, and you paste it on a pin, and then you follow the news. You'd follow where the armies were, and as the American or British soldiers moved into Libya, you'd stick a pin in there, you know. And then when they landed on D-Day in Normandy, well, you'd put a pin there. And so I remember quite a long time, I had pins, and I followed the war, and I faithfully put those pins in to show where the armies were fighting. And again, that was out of the newspaper, but everything was World War II, of course. And of course, guys from Niagara went into the service, and I remember, you know, the older brother, one of my friends, was killed, I think, in France. And I remember going to the memorial service for him. And
Linda also vividly remembered April 12th, 1945, the day Franklin Roosevelt died.
I was born in 1933. In those days, the president was inaugurated on March 4th. I was born on March 2nd. I had Herbert Hoover for president for 2 days of my life, day one and day two. On the third day of my life, Roosevelt was inaugurated. And then, as you know, he was elected to 4 terms, and he died in 1945. So then I was, 12 years old. And so he's the only president I knew, you know, through 12 years of my life in the news and anything else. And I still remember I got out of school the day that it was April 12th, 1945. I got out of school and I went down to the hardware store because my friend's dad owned it and I was looking for my friend. And I walked into the hardware store and my friend's dad, he said, "Did you hear that Roosevelt died?" And I still remember stiffening up, the shock of it.
Truman Ness was 10 years old when the war finally ended.
I remember when the war was over, they declared that one day that it must have been when Japan surrendered. And so the total war was over. In the afternoon, it was announced. So my oldest brother went to the Lutheran Church, and his friend went to the Presbyterian Church and rang the church bell for about an hour. So that was a big thing in the town.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and we are airing an excerpt from the Dakota Journalist podcast as we learn about the childhood and early career experiences of newspaper journalists across North and South Dakota. Still to come, we hear how the advent of television changed their careers.
Prairie Public is proud to present the live storytelling event, The Moth, November 14th at the Fargo Theater. Tickets available now at Tickets 300 or online at jadepresents.com.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thorberg, and today we are airing an excerpt from the Dakota Journalists podcast with host Terry Finneman. This episode explores how early career and childhood experiences shaped the lives and work of those journalists.
After the war came the baby boomer era and the rise of television.
Television really, at about the end of the war, was just coming into view. We used to go down Main Street, which was about two blocks from my house, and a person who had an electric company, an appliance company, would put a television with a speaker outside in his front window, and we would go over to the next door filling station, get a Coke case for 24 bottles of Coca-Cola, empty, and take it over in front of Church and Harbison and sit on it and watch television in the window. I mean, it was very new and very local.
Linda Seiler remembers the day her family got its first television.
I remember, funny, the little things you remember. I was about second grade, and they brought our TV in from town to put up, and they'd crawl in the roof and put up the big antennas, and we'd get two stations, Bismarck and Dickinson. And Howdy Doody was always on. That was fun. And before that, we'd go to the neighbors to watch TV because we didn't have a TV. It was a big deal. I still remember the day we got the TV. The fact that they had trouble getting it to be zeroed in on the right channel because the TV screen had to be pointed just perfectly. And then we got to watch cartoons, dear God, and we'd watch the news. And I can't remember any of the movies. Oh, of course, Lone Ranger, Roy Rogers. Yeah, it was a good day.
Roger Bailey has memories of spending time with his father watching political news on television.
Well, my most vivid memory of news back then was staying up until the wee hours of the morning with my dad watching the national political conventions on television. I mean, this is Huntley and Brinkley, I guess, in that era. And it was exciting to me even back then, and so meaningful to me to be watching them with my dad. I mean, he had to be up at 7 in the morning and on the job, but some of those conventions, if I recall correctly, lasted until 3 or 4 in the morning, and yet we hung with them right to the bitter end.
Oh, Walter Cronkite, of course. But he wasn't the only one. You know, we had so much trust in the avuncular Walter Cronkite. But we also had Howard K. Smith over at ABC, and we had Huntley Brinkley on NBC. And these were all highly regarded professionals. CBS had more numbers, but these other stations had great followings as well, because they were very much respected and trusted.
As television gained ground during the 1950s and 60s, the United States was once again at war. Richard Peterson remembers his confusion as a child hearing about the Korean War, which lasted from 1950 to 1953.
Well, I was too young to remember World War II, but I do remember the newsreels that would tell about things after the war, and I remember that the outbreak of the Korean War, that was kind of scary. They were talking about the guerrillas, and we thought that they were training wild guerrillas to fight with the Americans, but of course that wasn't the case.
John F. Kennedy's death on November 22, 1963, seared into the memories of millions of Americans who will never forget what they were doing when they heard the news.
I had become the editor of the Benson County Farmers Press on November 1, 1963, and Kennedy was shot on 22nd. That was the most traumatic thing that I've been through, tell you the truth. Kennedy was so young, he was so vibrant, and he was quite well thought of by the populace, I think. And he had a beautiful wife and nice kids, and here this guy gets rubbed out. It's terrible. It was terrible. And we all felt the pain of it. We all felt personally that we were damaged by this. I know when I heard about it, I was in Devil's Lake selling ads. And after I heard that, why, I just went home. Forgot about the ads. Good thing, I guess, too. It was tough. But the nation survived. And we can survive anything, I think, if we can get through that.
Mike Jacobs will also never forget that day.
I was in geometry class, and they interrupted the class on the intercom. It was really abrupt, because, of course, none of us had any idea, and they just turned the radio on. And so we heard news bulletins about the president having been shot. We didn't have television, we went into town to my Uncle Johnny's place and watched at their place and watched Oswald being shot on live TV. Astonishing. Watched the funeral. My mother was, I think, particularly attracted to Kennedy because of the Catholic connection, because she had been raised Catholic. So it was a big personal loss as well.
More death and emotional upheaval followed in the 1960s with assassinations of Martin Luther King Jr., Bobby Kennedy, and Malcolm X, as well as with the Vietnam War.
I was in high school during the height of the Vietnam War. I watched body bags come off the airplanes. I was a junior in high school the day I thought we were going to be in World War II, because President Kennedy said Khrushchev had to take his missiles away from Cuba. That was a big day. It was scary. So those were the two big events that I remember as a younger person, is the Vietnam War. Well, I felt a little guilty, because the TV would kind of... Did they put a spin on we need to support our Americans. We need to support what President Lyndon Johnson was doing, and we were so against the war.
Jack Marsh was a college student at Baldwin Wallace University in Ohio between 1967 and 1971, a time of anti-Vietnam War protests among college-age students. On May 4, 1970, four students at nearby Kent State University were killed and nine injured when the Ohio National Guard opened fire on war protesters.
A true social revolution was going on. And one of the reasons why it centered so much on college campuses was that we all had college deferments. The way the draft worked is as long as you stayed in college, the draft was deferred for you until upon graduation. So, it was our generation being sent to Vietnam, and it was our generation that was truly impacted by it. And it was primarily... Those who graduated from high school and did not go into college, those are the ones who primarily went to Vietnam, not exclusively, of course. But there was, this country was so divided in that period of the late 60s. I think about 1968, which was the end of my freshman year, the start of my sophomore year. I mean, we had two major assassinations, Martin Luther King, Bobby Kennedy. That was also the Tet Offensive in Vietnam, where the North Vietnamese basically invaded the South, caught us completely off guard. There were riots in the streets throughout the United States, major protests. We were, as a nation, and as a society, we were in tough, tough shape. When the Kent State shootings occurred, our school shut down. You had the option of taking an incomplete in every single class. You didn't have to go back to school, and then you could finish up in the fall if you wanted to. But, we had massive protests on our campus, just as there were on campuses all over the country. One of the people who was, one of the men who was killed at Kent State, his sister was editor of the yearbook. And so for her, it was a personal tragedy. So she left school to be with her family. I was in Ohio, a short distance away from Kent State. It had a profound impact because if it could happen at Kent State, it could happen anywhere. This wasn't Kent State University wasn't considered a violent place or a place with left wing radicals. These were young people who were protesting the draft, who were protesting the war, and things got out of hand.
If you enjoyed the stories in this episode, think about what memories you have of important events in local or national history. Consider writing them down or recording them so that future generations will benefit from these stories.
That was host Terry Finneman from the Dakota Journalists Podcast, a project bringing to life the oral histories of newspaper journalists across both North and South Dakota. It's sponsored by the North Dakota Newspaper Association and the South Dakota Newspaper Association. You can listen to all of their podcast episodes at dakotajournalists.podbean.com. Still to come on Main Street, Sue Balcom teaches us about buckwheat, and Harvest Public Media explores climate change and agriculture. But now it's time for the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. A pipeline company in North Dakota's oil patch has paid a $1,000 fine for a violation of pipeline safety rules. The Public Service Commission says the pipeline inspector did an audit of Caliber North Dakota's LLC records.
Caliber did not have maintenance, inspection, and testing records related to a pressure safety valve available at its field location in Watford City.
PSC Chairman Brian Krasha says that's required by federal regulations.
While they were able to produce those documents at a later date, they didn't have them on hand during the inspection period.
Krasha says the valve had been inspected in a timely manner, and he says these inspections are an important function of the Commission's pipeline safety program.
We're out. We've got inspectors out looking at the companies, making sure they're doing what they need to do to maintain lines in a safe and in a safe manner, because that inspection can ward off or can head off any potential problems that would be damaging and then result in injury or harm to people and the environment.
The pipeline runs from the Hay Butte gas plant to the Northern Border Pipeline. Over the past 15 months, a Department of Interior task force has been active with efforts to crack down on opioids and the illicit drug trade on tribal lands across the U.S. Charles Addington is director for the Bureau of Indian Affairs Office of Justice Services.
We have actually been across 9 states now with the operations, and there's been multiple tribes. We, like in Arizona, we had almost 10 plus pueblos in that operation. So we're trying to touch as many reservations that we can when we go out and do these in the areas.
Addington says there has also been activity by the task force in North Dakota as recently as this past spring.
We had about 75 arrests that took place and took quite a bit of methamphetamine, some heroin, prescription pills, and marijuana off the street during that operation.
Addington says task force members work closely with local and state law enforcement during the operations. He says they also work directly with tribal leadership.
It's a really big issue for tribal leadership. Tribal leaders are trying to keep the reservations safe. They want their communities safe, and this is just a great tool for us to go out and assist the community with getting the illegal narcotics out of their communities and keeping them safe.
Addington says it's a tough battle, but headway is being made. He says because of the high level of demand, when you remove one drug from the street, there is another waiting to take its place. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. In the rural Midwest, the number of people who believe in climate change is growing, but it still can be a touchy subject. For Harvest Public Media, Marley Baldridge went in search of the creative ways people bring up climate change in conversation without saying those words.
Mark Junker usually helps clean up hazardous waste sites with the Sac and Fox Tribal Nation of Missouri in Kansas and Nebraska's Environmental Department. But today, he'll drive 6 hours between Kansas, Iowa, and his home in Falls City, Nebraska, delivering flyers that summarize regional climate change to tribal clinics and facilities.
Sometimes pays to make the drive.
Hello.
Hello, how are you guys today?
Good, how are you?
Well, I brought some more. I started making them after seeing how they were done at the Wind River Reservation. I thought it would be something to be useful for the four Kansas tribes to have as a reference tool, a decision-making tool.
He's in Hiawatha, Kansas today, in Brown County, home to nearly 10,000 people, and 61% of them believe in global warming, according to Yale's Program on Climate Change Communication. This challenges the stereotype that, in flyover country, folks don't believe in climate change. As Paula Dennison and anyone else who's lived in a rural place can tell you, it's not that simple.
No, not at all.
Dennison is the assistant city manager of Stillwater, Oklahoma. Most people believe in global warming here, just like in Hiawatha. Not that everyone would call it that.
Oh, we talk about it, but no, we don't. We don't use the term climate change.
It's hard for her to describe what Oklahomans view. But when she talks about climate change in terms of what people can do and connects them to resources, Dennison finds that folks are much more likely to buy into a solution than a problem. She's not the first one to figure this out.
When was the last time you heard a whippoorwill at night? How many hoot owls do you hear at night as opposed to how many you used to hear? You know, things like that to get people to think about, well, yeah, you know, things have changed a lot in a relatively short amount of time.
Jane Ellen Ross hosts living history workshops, like how to make medicine from plants, near her home in Huntsville, Arkansas. Huntsville has a population of a little more than 2,300 people, and more than half believe in global warming. She says that when people talk about the past, they don't realize they're talking about the effects of climate change. This spring, the Missouri River flooded parts of Nebraska, Iowa, Missouri, and Kansas. Junker says that people in the area were calling it a 100-year flood, except that the label doesn't really mean anything anymore.
It's like you're having a 100-year flood happening every 5 or 6 years.
The most recent National Climate Report says that because rural communities depend more on the land but have fewer resources, like extensive infrastructure or political clout, or are less affluent, the people that live there face what's called the climate gap. That means that people may need to drive 30 miles to recycle their glass and plastic. It might mean that they don't have reliable internet to even find out about recycling programs in the first place. To close the gap, Junker, Ross, and Dennison feel the answer is to keep talking, however possible. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Marley Baldridge.
Harvest Public Media is a public media reporting collaboration focusing on America's farm and rural issues. Sue Balcom is next.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Hey, do you have a guest idea, a comment, or a question? It's easy to contact us. You can email us at mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or on Facebook, we're Main Street at Prairie Public. Or you can call us toll-free, 888-755-6377. We want to hear from you.
Support is provided by Benedictine Living Center of Garrison, providing long-term skilled nursing care, short-stay rehabilitation, outpatient therapy, and assisted and independent living. A member of the Benedictine Health System, blcgarrison.com.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and in the Fargo studio with me is Doug Hamilton, and joining us from Bismarck for Main Street Eats is Root Cellar Sue.
Sue, we're going to talk about buckwheat. Educate me.
Well, first of all, I tried to talk my daughter into trying buckwheat because it's a gluten-free seed. And she's like, how can that be? It's called buckwheat. And I'm like, I know, but it's a total vegetable. It is not a wheat at all. And so I've been experimenting with this because, as you know, there's people that are gearing towards not eating luscious sourdough bread that I bake because it has gluten in it from the wheat flour.
I'll take theirs.
Yeah.
More
oh,
for me.
God, yes. We had sourdough toast the other day, and I'm like, I've forgotten how wonderful this is. But farmer market season is coming up here real soon, if not has already begun, and then I'll start baking again. But I have been experimenting with buckwheat. My friend has a 100% certified organic farm near Wing, North Dakota, and I think they actually grow buckwheat as a weed deterrent in organic fields. So she has this unhulled buckwheat. You can't find unhulled buckwheat in the grocery store.
I have a pillow that's full of buckwheat hulls.
Oh, yes, yeah. That's right. And you can also make those heating packs out of those that you put in the microwave.
Yeah.
And then my friend Seema, who is actually Lithuanian and she lives in Elgin, North Dakota, has always asked me about doing buckwheat bread. She eats hulled buckwheat like you would rice or frika or oatmeal. You know, you can make breakfast food out of it. So I thought, oh, I got to start working with this. So I ground some buckwheat and made some sourdough bread, which several of my customers said was amazing. And I don't know what the quality in it that would help that bread rise, but I could use 50% buckwheat flour with the hulls and 50% whole wheat or white flour and still get a lovely, soft, and tender crumb on a piece of sourdough bread. Mm. So I was trying to get people to at least try this. So I'm going to help this woman kind of market this at our market this summer. When you grind the flour, you can sift out the dark hull, but it makes for beautiful looking bread and pancakes because it's dark, really dark on the outside, and it's kind of earthy and nutty flavor. Have you ever had buckwheat pancakes?
I have, yeah.
Okay.
I think I have. Yeah.
That's probably the most popular use of buckwheat, but you know, it's so good for you. It lowers cholesterol and blood pressure, of course, and then it has antioxidants, and it's a highly digestible protein, which is why, in addition to the sourdough concept with the bread, by adding the buckwheat in there, you're actually improving what causes the gluten intolerant thing, which they say is the proteins that we can't break down in our bodies. And if I'm totally wrong about that, somebody will have to write us and tell me that. But in the meantime, that's my understanding of how that all works.
Well, my experience in the baking aisle is all-purpose flour. where do I find buckwheat?
Well, I can send you some because we're gonna hopefully they're kind of looking for a market for their buckwheat. One of the things that's really difficult with the different kinds of grains, the ancient grains, the spelt and the buckwheat and the einkorn and all those kinds of things, is that our industrial food system is set up to process only certain things.
Right.
You know, like your carrots all have to be uniform size, and God did not make carrots to be all uniform. I'm sorry.
And baby carrots are carrots that have been kind of
that tumbled in a washing machine or something to get them to soften
created.
Up there. But yeah. But so in order – you can get Bob's Red Mill. I think that you can find buckwheat there. And so you can eat the hulled stuff as cereal or cook it as a grain. But, you know, the stuff that's organic, like with the hull on, you can actually do microgreens with it. Mm. You can sprout it like bean sprouts. But you can – I've actually – oh, you're going to love this. I've actually made egg noodles with buckwheat. And then we eat fried – potatoes and fried noodles with breadcrumbs and butter. And that is amazing because that buckwheat noodle fries up a little extra crispy. And who doesn't like crispy flour products, you know? So
no friend of mine.
No friend of mine either, boy. And like I said, and then the color is so absolutely cool. Now, one thing you have to be careful about if you're going to introduce buckwheat into your diet is the fact that it is a high fiber food. So drink a lot of water with it and maybe start out really, really slow. you know, just
right.
in case, right?
Uh-huh. Maybe don't also increase how much broccoli you eat at the
right,
same time.
Right, right. You want to, maybe that's why the noodles are really a good thing. But it's supposed to be non-allergenic, you know, and of course without the gluten, it has lots of vitamins and minerals in. Can help prevent diabetes for some reason. I'm not sure how that works. But buckwheat, the hulled stuff is buckwheat whole grain, and then if you want the stuff that's got the hulls on it, look for buckwheat groats.
Now, do you typically use pure buckwheat or do you mix it with flour? I mean, obviously, if you're making it gluten-free, you'd have to be careful about that, but do you blend it with flour?
I do because I really like flour and wheat and that kind of bread. You know, that's something that we eat a lot of at our house, but there are recipes for buckwheat flour bread, but you have to understand that this would be very much more dense than a bread that has flour in because of the lack of gluten.
So earlier you said that you ground this yourself. Is that something you can do in a common household blender, or do you need a more specialized item for grinding buckwheat?
I have been known to use the blender. Of course, it'll probably dull your blades because it really does have a – if you're just doing a small amount, it would probably be okay. You know, like I have a chocolate chip cookie recipe that uses a quarter cup of flour, and that would be easy enough to duplicate in your blender. But I also have a KitchenAid mixer, you know, that has an attachment that you could grind. So let's say if you wanted to make a loaf of bread here or there, I would highly recommend buying that attachment because I love fresh ground flour. It doesn't react like older flour.
Right.
I almost said something bad there. But, you know, the flour you buy in the store has been there for a while. So and wheat berries can keep, you know, 3 or more years in your house. So you'd always have wheat. You can always have wheat berries. And then you grind your flour and use it within 3 days so that it doesn't become rancid from the oils in there. But I use a Nutrimill. It was kind of like one of those things that I thought, you know, I would really like to grind more flour. And so they're under $300. depending upon where you buy them, you can get free shipping maybe, and that would make it even a better deal. But I love to experiment with these kinds of things. And buckwheat has proven to be something that's really piqued my interest. And so after this summer at the farmer's market, I'll have a little bit more data from my customers, because we are selling it as a whole grain for people to use that way or grind themselves, or I'm grinding it and putting it into my bread products. So,
well, that's root cellar sale.
Absolutely. Here I am.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
What's happening is next.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the North Dakota Farmers Market and Growers Association, helping North Dakota farmers, ranchers, and gardeners market their products through farmers markets, grocery stores, and restaurants statewide. Learn more at ndfarmersmarkets.org.
That is the question we seek to answer once a week here on Prairie Public. And joining me to tackle that question is Director of Radio Bill Thomas.
Hi.
What you got?
Well, Friday in Bismarck at the Heritage Center and State Museum, they often come up on what's happening. There's always a lot of interesting things going on there. They, you know, they get so much stuff donated. They get books and records and newspapers and everything, and they digitized a lot of it. And some of it is duplicates. And anyway, they've got a surplus. So they're having a sale. 4,000 shellac 78 records, boxes of sheet music and newspapers and other documents. And a lot of things priced at a dollar or even a dollar per pound. So that's this Friday at the North Dakota Heritage Center and State Museum.
Own a piece of history for a dollar per pound.
Get there early. Starts at 8 in the morning, goes to 5 p.m.
The Dueling Duo is performing in Grand Forks at the Euland Park Softball Complex. This is tomorrow, the 28th. So this is a group that has been entertaining audiences all over the Midwest for more than a decade. So this is fiddle, sax, and piano group playing together, the Dueling Duo, Friday the 28th in Grand Forks at the Euland Park Softball Complex. Gets going at 6 o'clock. There's going to be food and beverage vendors available on site. Tickets are just $10.
And in Park River on Saturday, starting at 11 a.m., it is the Tour de Rendezvous. If you can't go to France for the Tour de France, well, you can do the Tour de Rendezvous in Park River this Saturday. And it's at the Lake Home Recreation Area. You can do the 20 or 60-mile route, complimentary meal served after the ride. I hope they got plenty to eat because you'd be hungry after doing that. There is a registration fee of $20 to participate.
Cash on Delivery, performing starting tonight and going through Monday, July 1st. Yes, June is almost already behind us. This is in Minot at Minot State University. This is a fast-paced British farce centering on a con artist who has duped welfare authorities. And you can imagine the shenanigans that will happen when the government tries to come after a con artist. There is a lot of mistaken identity. Slamming doors. 8:30 to 11 are the show times for Thursday through Monday at Minot State University. Tickets are $16.
Yeah, that's very funny. He has to come up with all these fake characters that he's been collecting benefits for.
That sounds great. Yeah.
All right. Well, sticking in Minot, but this is outdoors. It's the rescue run for Bell's Sake Animal Rescue and Rehabilitation, a 5K run or walk. You don't have to run. It's this Saturday, starts at noon, and it's to raise money and awareness for this charity. It begins at Atypical Brewery and Barrel Works in downtown Minot, goes through the Roosevelt Park and surrounding areas, back at Atypical for a family-friendly party, medals for the fastest ones, men, women, and children. And it's a $30 registration fee, all for animal rescue. And watch the weather. There's a possibility, not a certainty, of weather to watch out for.
Shakespeare in the Park presenting The Merry Wives of Windsor this Friday in Sydney, Montana at Veterans Memorial Park. So rumor has it Queen Elizabeth herself commissioned this play because she wanted to, well, she wanted to see what apparently she called a fat knight in love. I did not fact check that myself.
Well, it's so. Falstaff, you know, so.
You can see The Merry Wives of Windsor performed this Friday the 28th in Sydney, Montana at Veterans Memorial Park. Bring a picnic food if you want, some blankets to sit on, and theater under the great big open sky. This gets going at 6:30 and it's free.
And in Detroit Lakes on Saturday, the 29th, the American Legion Post 15 is doing a pig roast and luau, welcoming back summer. It should be pretty summery. Kings of Karaoke, Elvis will be there. Raffles, silent auctions, dunk tanks, all that kind of fun stuff, including grass skirts, starting at 5 p.m. on Saturday in Detroit Lakes, $13.
The Wonder Woman Run is this Saturday in Fargo, where you can meet at the starting point of Main Avenue and Broadway. Get your cape and join your fellow superheroes when you run or walk the Fargo Wonder Woman 5K, 10K, or half marathon. This gets going at 7:30 in the morning. So if you are not registered to race, go out there and cheer on these racers. The race gets going again at 7:30 in the morning for the Wonder Woman Run, starting at Main Avenue and Broadway in Fargo. What's your pick?
Well, my pick of the week is Jasuso, which means remember. Jasuso 1960. It's a Somali week, and this is a celebration of Somalia in Moorhead on Sunday, starting at 6:30 at the Horizon West Campus Auditorium. There will be a showing of the film Somalia, a Nation of Poets, because poetry is really important there, and they'll be celebrating culture and history and Independence Day, Somali Independence Day, film, photography, performances, a lot of fun. 6:30, it's free on Sunday in Moorhead.
Well, mine is a happy little crafternoon. This combines so many of my favorite things here. Bob Ross pretending to be good at crafts and meeting at coffee shops. So all those happy little accidents that happen when you're trying to craft, well, they just turn into something else. You make them a happy little bird when you follow Bob Ross's advice, or make him a happy little tree. The point is to celebrate the joy of creating and learn a few techniques to try to make your painting a little bit better. And you even get the chance to take your mini canvas home for your own wall. This is at 2:30 and it goes until about 5 o'clock on Saturday in Bismarck at Cafe Aroma for a happy little crafternoon. And tickets to the event or registration is $25 because they are giving you all the art supplies. That's what's happening.
This is Dakota Datebook for June 27th. North Dakota remembers Theodore Roosevelt, featuring the words of Roosevelt as performed by Steve Stark. The dawn of the burgeoning 20th century America cast light on both poverty and progress. Health and public welfare conditions were limited at best, horrific and deadly at worst. Crusading reporters and newspapers began public exposés against questionable patent medicines, quack practitioners, exploitative businessmen, filthy food preparation, and squalid working conditions. Theodore Roosevelt joined in the fight with the newspaper scribes he dubbed muckrakers. As president, T.R. campaigned for sweeping legislative reform with the Pure Food and Drug Act passed in 1902. These efforts would lead to America's Food and Drug Administration.
The enactment of a pure food law was a recognition of the fact that the public welfare outweighs the right to private gain, and that no man may poison the people for his private profit. The federal government has been able to accomplish a great benefit to the public in the direction of protecting it from impure and misbranded foods and drugs. The work begun must be carried forward in the interest of both the public and the body of food producers who are engaged in honest business. A broadly effective and successful enforcement of law depends upon the support of an aroused and intelligent public opinion. Much has been done in stopping traffic in unhealthy and adulterated foodstuffs, but there remains yet more to do, and the progress which has been made must be safeguarded. No people are more vitally interested than working men and women in questions of public health. The pure food law must be strengthened and efficiently enforced. There must be public opinion back of the laws, or the laws themselves will be of no avail. We propose that the people shall control both the legislatures and the courts, not to pervert the Constitution, but to overthrow those who themselves pervert the Constitution into an instrument for perpetuating injustice.
Today's Dakota Datebook was written and performed by Steve Stark. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the Historical Society of North Dakota. This series with funding from the Theodore Roosevelt Medora Foundation.
This week on the Thomas Jefferson Hour, we talked about public opinion and it being baked in.
That phrase, baked in, first surfaced in the 2016 election, at least for me. The question is, are we hopelessly baked in, or is there still the possibility that some of our minds can be opened and that we can find mutual conciliation and accommodation in this, our American Republic?
And we talk about how the lack of civil discourse this causes can really be an aid to those against us.
So the question is, were we always this way, and we just notice it more now, or have things turned in kind of a dark, baked-in partisanship in the 21st century?
And then we do an exercise where we talk about a mythical third party, the Jeffersonian Party, and what it would stand for.
In foreign policy, in the economy and taxation, in war and peace, etc. And I said, I'm tan, rested, and ready.
Join us for all that and more on this week's Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Sunday at 11 Central, 10 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
How did violence outside the Stonewall Inn in New York City 50 years ago help define the push for queer rights?
They could now fight back for all the times they had to slink away without being able to say anything and take whatever crap the cops were giving at them. And once it broke loose, it was very contagious.
Why we remember Stonewall. Plus more reaction from the Democratic debate on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Thursday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, technology changes so quickly. How can we use that to our advantage, especially when it comes to educating eager young learners? We have a discussion with Prairie Public's own Darcy Backegaard about some cool uses of new technology, including virtual reality, in the classroom and outside the classroom, to keep your young students occupied. That's tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.